church is in Africa, at the service of reconciliation, peace and justice.
The church is in Africa, at the service of reconciliation, peace and justice.
This is the Africa service of Vatican Radio.
Welcome to our half-hour daily program for Africa.
Stay tuned for our bulletin of church news, which will be followed by Panorama, and then our feature, Culture and Society. We shall close with the news for young people. I am John Baptist Tumusime. On Thursday, Pope Francis received in audience the President of Argentina, Mr. Alberto Fernandez. A statement issued by the Holy See after the meeting said Mr. Fernandez later held a meeting with the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolini. The two held cordial talks and appreciated the good bilateral relations between the Holy See and Argentina. They also discussed the situation in Argentina with particular reference to the management of the COVID-19 pandemic, the economic financial crisis, and the fight against poverty, as well as the contribution of the Catholic Church to the Argentine society. Pope Francis has reminded Catholics that the Church is beautiful because she is loved by her bridegroom, the Lord Jesus Christ. He made the reminder in a preface he has written to a book by two Italian Franciscan priests, Father Valentino Natalini and Father Ferdinando Campana. The book explores the theology of consecrated life. Devin Watkins has the details.
Like Salt and Yeast, Notes for a Theology of the Consecrated Life of the Church, hits the bookshelves of the Vatican Publishing House on Friday and bears a preface by Pope Francis. The book was written by two Italian Franciscan priests who seek to take stock of the Church's teaching on a range of topics related to the consecrated life. In his preface for the new book, Pope Francis begins by laying out why the Church can be considered beautiful. The Church is beautiful because she is loved by her bridegroom and Lord, he says, and the love of the bridegroom has made her fruitful, beautiful, and happy. Launching into the topic of consecrated life, the Pope points out that the Church has always been composed of three states of life: the single life, married life, and consecrated life. He adds that these are not three separate compartments in constant competition or even three islands in a vast ocean. The holy people of God discern well, he says, when within itself it can count three brothers or even three splendid creatures who support each other and give themselves to each other in order to help the other grow. Pope Francis goes on to note that throughout the Church's history, one or another of the three states of life has been held up as the best, offering a guaranteed path to holiness. He says this tendency has often coincided with a dark time in the Church's human affairs, leading to abuse and misguided claims. The Pope adds that proponents of the consecrated life have, at various times in history, claimed a form of autonomy with respect to the other two states of life. He says this presumption risks making the Church a jumble of self-referential subjects. Each becomes proud and presumptuous of their own prerogatives, he says, forgetting that one arrives first when all three subjects arrive together at the same goal. The Pope then praises the book as written by an experienced and proven theologian who examines the magisterium with the purity of a neophyte. He is assisted by a younger confrère who is a liturgist, a lover of theology and spirituality, and a longtime dear friend of the Pope. Pope Francis concludes his preface expressing his desire that the book might help us to deepen our understanding of the mystery of the hierarchical Holy Mother Church. I'm Devin Watkins.
The office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has warned that the military in Myanmar has not shown any sign of stopping its oppressive activities against the citizens of the country despite efforts by the international community to end the violence. The military overthrew an elected government on February 1st this year and declared itself the legitimate government. The citizens have been holding peaceful protests calling for an end to military rule, but the junta has responded by firing live bullets at the protesters, killing many, and by detaining more than 3,000 others. A study published in an academic journal known as Sociology of Religion by two renowned researchers Nilei Saia and Mututi Machanda shows that Christianity is on the rise in African countries, despite the harsh religious environment on the continent, characterized by persecution of Christians and lack of government support for churches. The study was carried out in 166 countries around the world to examine the relationship between the growth of Christianity and the support given to it by the respective governments. 10 of the countries were in Africa, and they are Tanzania, Malawi, Zambia, Uganda, Rwanda, Madagascar, Liberia, Kenya, the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Angola. In all of them, the number of Christians was growing fast, but only in Kenya, Tanzania, and Zambia, the churches have some form of support from the state. Meanwhile, the study showed also that Christianity was declining in several Western countries and in Eastern Europe. You are tuned to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio.
African News Panorama.
A South African-born pharmaceutical businessman, Dr. Patrick Soon-Shiong, who is based in the United States of America, has said his family's foundation will spend $211 million to help develop vaccine production in South Africa. Speaking to officials of the World Health Organization on Wednesday, Dr. Soon-Shiong said he wanted the donation to transfer the know-how around vaccine development and build self-sufficiency and innovation. At the moment, Africa is not able to produce its own COVID-19 vaccines and has received a small fraction of the doses it needs to cover its population. The African Union has extended its peace mission in Somalia following a lapse in security caused by the recent conflict between President Mohamed Farmajo and Parliament. The president wanted to extend his mandate after it expired in February. The National Army was divided, part of it supporting the president and another part opposing his decision to prolong his stay in office. The United Nations Security Council, which has the last say on the matter, has supported the plan and is expected to extend the mandate of the peace mission before the end of this month. The African Union mission in Somalia is intended to stabilize the country and to deter Al-Shabaab Islamic militants from spreading their terror within and outside Somalia. The president of Gabon, Ali Bongo, said on Thursday that he wants his country to join the Commonwealth during the summit scheduled for next month in Kigali, Rwanda. Speaking in London, Mr. Bongo said the integration of Gabon into the Commonwealth would be a historical milestone. The Commonwealth is an association of mainly former colonies of Britain. Currently, it has 54 member states who share the common goals of development, democracy, and peace. At the moment, only Mozambique and Rwanda are the African member states who were not British colonies. Gabon is a former French colony. You are tuned to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio.
This is Culture and Society, and you are welcome to the program. My name is Kanyan Tagodufri Kampamba. Public service journalism is in danger of extinction because of the impact of COVID-19. As it is well known, media which serves the public interest not only provides vital information communities need in order to take informed action, but it also dispels misinformation, strengthens democratic accountability, and boosts sustainable development. Yet, regardless of this important role that public media plays in society, journalism has been hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic. The impact is so much so that it has dried up revenue and put its very existence into question. Chitao Vyas is the founding executive director of International Fund for Public Interest Media. In a special interview with Vibhu Mishra from the United Nations News, Vyas speaks about the fund's bold billion-dollar rescue plan to help save journalism for the public good.
It's actually very hard to think of a time in recent history when access to trustworthy information has been more important. And yet, this public good, this provision of services that they're providing, this vital public good, is dying out due to a lack of funding. And we know why this lack of funding exists. The advertising model of the internet has decimated the business model of journalism. The fact is that news media have nearly always struggled to turn a profit. But despite this, they have managed to survive with a commercial model. But with print media revenues in decline and income from digital media not adequately compensating, that business model has reached breaking point, and COVID has exacerbated this. Low and middle income countries are disproportionately affected, receiving less digital advertising revenue from platforms than what's received in richer countries. And actually, they're finding it harder to respond to this business model challenge. So at a time when access to reliable information can be a matter of life or death, evidence from multiple surveys, such as the Journalism and the Pandemic Project, show that the global pandemic has accelerated the financial decline of these organizations around the world. In fact, the global loss in revenue is estimated at over $30 billion for the last 12 months alone for newspapers. So experts are warning that this loss could lead to a media extinction event.
People and communities are depending more than ever on media to give them accurate and timely information. Can public support, which is high right now, particularly surging traffic on digital media, be enough to stave off other factors that might lead to an extinction-level threat?
There's been a consistent trend, actually, throughout the pandemic that people have flocked in huge numbers to media that the public regard as trustworthier. Maria Ressa, the founder of Rappler in the Philippines, has called this flight to quality. But unfortunately, those increases in audiences are not necessarily translating into increased revenues or a viable business model. So the same media organizations who the public is relying on to keep them informed is often at the same time laying off journalists. And this is the challenge. So in many markets, even when the digital traffic is very high, it's not translating into significant revenues in low income markets. An example of this is Al Mirabad in southern Iraq, which is a radio station but also has a digital platform. They have massive listenership figures and their YouTube traffic is in the millions. But the revenue they're receiving from digital advertising revenue is not commensurate. And actually, it does need external support to survive and deliver their services.
Against this, what needs to happen? Is the answer merely boosting advertising revenue? Or are there actions that governments, the public, and the private sector must take?
There's a clear market failure. Journalism is struggling to fund itself, and people are expecting content for free now. And that's kind of hard to recover from. But it's not impossible. But what we do know is it will take us time to figure out new models that work. Now, you know, what do we do when there's a market failure for other public goods? Well, usually the state finds a way of supporting these goods. But in media, that's really complicated because if states fund journalism, it kind of gets messy and there's just too much scope for editorial interference. So the idea with the International Fund for Public Interest Media is that we will sustain media during the time that it needs it the most to avoid this media extinction event. Our mission is to help these organizations during a period where their business model needs to evolve by doing effectively three things. The first is to provide support that will be financial and non-financial to help them sustain. But it's really important to note here that these are not operational subsidies that will reinforce a dependency culture. But actually, what we want to do is help them catalyze new solutions for sustainability. These grants may provide match funding or technical support to help them create a new new sustainable model of operation that will enable them to last in the digital world. But thirdly, we also want to create new approaches to supporting media in countries at the macro level as well, to create an environment that can optimize success and make the market of support work more efficiently. We are seeing really new promising models of journalism, whether that's membership models, models that are using more direct relationships with audiences. And these models could emerge as innovative and sustainable, but those models don't emerge overnight. And we're going to need to support the sector while we figure out how to evolve. And the cost of not doing that is just unimaginable.
Are some media outlets better positioned than others to weather the storm? Is there a regional dimension to this crisis?
The worst effects of the media crisis are in countries with either A, already weak advertising markets, B, where the economic as well as the political impacts of the COVID pandemic have hit media revenue the hardest, or C, where the media are especially vulnerable to political co-option or capture. You know, some governments have used the restrictions justified by the pandemic to actually further curtail media. In this sense, there's not necessarily a region specific. Some media markets are more vulnerable or resilient than others within specific regions. But our fund will focus on low and middle income countries, but it will be organized in a highly decentralized way, with the most funding decisions decided at the regional level. It's really important that decision making is as close as possible to the countries that we support, because we want to tailor our support strategies to the specific country context within which we're working in. We really want to have a strong understanding of the media markets within which we operate, and also, really importantly, the political economy of the countries and the potential for a long-term approach that might chart an exit strategy from the current media market failure.
Can you tell us more about the International Fund for Public Interest Media and how it aims to help?
This idea has been in the making for almost 2 years now, and it's been guided by an advisory group of international journalists and media experts. Our idea, which is massively ambitious, but it needs to be, is to create a large-scale $1 billion response to this media market failure, this media extinction, focused especially on low and middle-income countries. It's a big idea, but trying to tackle this problem requires a big idea. We've undertaken extensive consultation with a wide range of stakeholders to this fund, and based on that evidence, we've designed this fund really with a number of principles in mind. The first is that it's an independent multilateral fund, which will allow media to be supported without the undue political interference from either donors or governments. We'll be supporting genuinely independent media. You know, historically, it's been hard to fund media due to this politicization. And we think an independent fund of this type, an independent multilateral fund of this type, would really help address this issue. The second principle is around the long-term sustainability of media organizations. We want to create a hub for experimenting with business models that could emerge as the future of journalism. We also want to support the enabling environment that supports and can nurture these media outlets. Our aim is that this fund sustains media over a 10 to 15 year period so that it can evolve and develop its own sustainable strategies. Third principle is that we want a decentralized model where we're working really closely with local organizations that understand the political economy and the country context within which we're working in. This fund cannot be removed from the realities that are faced on the ground. And finally, we're seeking new funding from those who have not historically supported media in the past. So we don't want to divert funding from the already great existing media support organizations that exist. But what we want to do is create a step change in the amount of funding that it's providing. You know, where is this money going to come from? Well, we're hoping that we can push the amount of overseas development assistance that goes to support media from the very low 0.3% that exists at the moment to ideally an average of 1%. But we're also seeking a diversity of funders. So not just international development agencies, but we're looking to technology companies and also philanthropic entities to support this, those who have an interest in supporting democracy and development. And our initial aim is to raise 100 million to prove the concept and build the foundations of an ambitious institution.
Is there anything that you would like to add?
We think now more than ever, we're seeing a moment where there is a need and a desire to support global media. I think it's the combination of, you know, the fundamental need to support democracy and hold institutions to account, But that combined with this massive increase that we've seen globally in mis and disinformation, which has been proliferated by social media, ensuring funding at the scale and pace required will be crucial to securing the long-term future of independent media organizations, especially in low and middle-income countries. Through these efforts, the international community can chart a path towards a new era of sustainable public interest journalism while helping to restore trust across society.
Founding Executive Director of International Fund for Public Interest Media, Sheetal Vyas, speaking there with Vibhu Mishra from the United Nations News about the fund's bold $1 billion rescue plan to help save journalism for the public good. And that is all we have time for today. Until next week at the same time, my name is Kanyan Tagodifrikampamba.
And now, news for young people.
Hello and welcome to the program. I am Festus Tarawali. The bishops of Southern Africa are calling on governments in the 9 countries of their region to put young people at the center of economic development. The call by the members of the Standing Committee of the Interregional Meeting of the Bishops of Southern Africa in Bisa came in a statement at the end of their April 27th meeting held in Johannesburg, South Africa. In their discussions on the general situation in the region, they noted that young people in particular have gone for long periods without attending school due to restrictions to curb the spread of the coronavirus. Even as learning moved online in some cases, the COVID-19 pandemic has simply revealed the problems of systemic inequalities in the economic sphere in the different countries of the region, with the poorer young people unable to access these online platforms, the Mbisa Standing Committee said in the statement. It further noted that the problems of inequality, especially in the economic space, has left many young people exposed to exploitation by those who foment violence and other social ills. As a result of a certain disenfranchisement, continued the statement, some young people have tended to migrate so as to eke out a living elsewhere, far from home and their normal surroundings. The Mbisa statement concluded by urging governments in the region to rethink their economic systems and to put young people at the center of every economic development. The Interregional Meeting of the Bishops of Southern Africa is made up of representatives of the Catholic Church of Angola, Botswana, Eswatini, Lesotho, Mozambique, Namibia, Sao Tome and Principe, South Africa and Zimbabwe. The director of its secretariat, based in Harare, Zimbabwe, Father Dumisani Benedict Vilagati, spoke to Sheila Furish about the concerns of the bishops on the issue of youth unemployment on the sidelines of the meeting in Johannesburg.
Well, certainly with the slowdown of the economic issues, many young people have lost jobs. In fact, they didn't have jobs in any case. As you will notice that since the pandemic began, schools have been erratic, opening, closing. Nothing is clear there. As you may have observed, even tertiary institutions have not been operating at their optimum. The same also with our seminaries have not been operating at their optimum. There's been a concern about formation, you know, the preparation of future priests. What type of priests will this be? What type of formation are they getting during this period of the pandemic? So clearly the youth are at the center, probably at the center of the discussions of the bishops here. In fact, at the last few years, there's been always a discussion among the bishops about strengthening Mbisa. That is, it was more inward-looking. The bishops themselves looking at themselves on how they can be together themselves. And it was mentioned clearly by one of the bishops here that, okay, we have done this well for ourselves. Now we need to get out of ourselves and say, what are we going to do for our youth? How can we assist our youth? Since the last synod, we have not really done much. Well, we've done something, but not much in terms of assisting our youth so that they can have a better future, notwithstanding the challenges that have been visited by us on us by the pandemic. Because what is happening, as it was ably indicated today here, is that in a country like Mozambique, with many young people not working, they are simply happy to join these insurgents, insurgents might be the term for now, and because they get a bit of money out of that, because they are not doing anything anyway. It's a similar thing also, which is probably happening in the Lunda North province of Angola, because even the young people who are dissatisfied about developments in the area, they see resources, but the resources don't benefit them. And then it's easy to just invite them so that they take up arms. So young people are vulnerable in this sense. It's important, therefore, maybe for a church in the region to come up with better strategies on how they can minister better to youth, which has not happened before. I mean, for the region just to start thinking about youth or only youth, no, it hasn't happened. Many things have been considered, like Laudato Si, abuse, family, and all sorts of other things. But youth as youth probably is an area that has not received the required attention.
That was Father Dumisani Benedict Vilakati, the director of the Harare-based secretariat of the Interregional Meeting of the Bishops of Southern Africa in Mbisa. And that's all for this edition of News for Young People. Till the same time next week, I am Festus Tarawali.
You have been listening to the English Africa service of Vatican Radio, and I am Johnny Baptist Tumusime. In our next program at the same time tomorrow, you can hear our feature, Development and the Economy. Praised be Jesus Christ. Laudetur Jesus Christus. Ah, 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 ah